Welcome to I Think You're Overthinking It, episode 1154. A couple show announcements. First of all, Wednesday, October 22nd in Irvine, California, I'll be performing at the Irvine Improv with my best buddy, Mike Furman. That show is at 8 p.m. There's one show, Irvine Improv, 8 p.m. Hope to see you there. And also, Mike and I are going to be performing at the Hartford Funny Bone in Hartford, Connecticut, November 14 and 15. So come on out if you're in that general area. Hartford's near a lot of other places, so you don't even necessarily need to be from Hartford. What is it, like 2 hours from Manhattan? Come on, that's not that far, right? Right? Well, anyway, we will be there November 14, 15, so hope to see you there. Now let's talk about this episode. This is my friend Ricky Lindholm, whom I adore. She is such an incredible writer, performer. I've known her forever. She is one half of Garfunkel & Oates. She's been doing a lot of solo stuff lately. And just in the last couple of years, she has written, self-produced, self-released an album called No Worries If Not, which is available now wherever you get your albums. And it's fantastic. And also, she's written and performed a one-person show called Dead Inside, which she did amazing shows at Edinburgh and just performed recently in DC, and I believe is planning to do more shows. But she is, and I say this many times to her, she is a constant source of inspiration to make, to create. And you know, if you are someone who just can't get out of your own head, can't get out of your own way to make stuff, please listen to this podcast, because she has so many great words of advice for how to just do stuff. I mean, Ricky's done so many fantastic things, you know, not just a one-person show, not just the album, but also, you know, and in her show Another Period, which was on Comedy Central the same time we did At Midnight, Ricky and Natasha Leggero did this fantastic show called Another Period. And, you know, like I said, Garfunkel and Oates, and I promise there are things that you will probably write down during this podcast to remember, to remind yourself when you go to create stuff, whatever it is that you're working on. I know I literally have made notes from this podcast. Oh yeah, she said this too. I got to remember to do this. I got to remember to do this. And when I tell myself this one story in my head about why I can't do X, Y, or Z, I need to remember this, or I need to remember to do it anyway. So thank you so much to Ricky for being a constant source of inspiration to make, to create, to put yourself out there in the world and put out such great stuff as she has. And, you know, I saw that she recently posted that she was hoping that her album, No Worries If Not, could get nominated for a Comedy Grammy. So listen, if you're a member of that Academy and you can help someone get nominated for a Comedy Grammy, then please do for Ricky's album, No Worries If Not. This is episode number 1154 of I Think You're Overthinking It with Ricky Lindholm. Start the thing! I'm not always down in Los Angeles, so this was sort of a makeshift setup here, like in front of the piano.
It's so cool.
And all the stuff. So I feel like I have like a light source right here, and I feel like I'm just catching all of the light. I'm a reflective. I could be a bounce card for someone, you know, if they were shooting, they could just bounce light off me.
That's good. I look particularly ghostly, and I'm not sure why. I'm always white, but I look like very ghostly.
You know why? Because it's like Halloween season. Yeah. Halloween.
I love Halloween.
Are you doing Halloween stuff this year?
Okay. Well, we're going to take my son, you know, trick-or-treating.
Yes.
Either here or in Portland. But I also have a tradition where, I don't know if this is true for you, but no one takes pictures of me at all. So I basically use Halloween as a way to get pictures with my son. Uh-huh. And I'll have multiple costumes, and we'll do like a photo shoot, and you know, my mom will shoot it or something, but I like do awesome costumes just so we have it like definite photos coming at least once a year.
That's fantastic. That's really fantastic. And so you already have, do you have the costumes all
planned out? I do. When is this coming out?
Probably in like a week.
Okay. So I don't want to say the one because it's, because my husband doesn't know about the one and it's going to be a fun surprise.
Okay.
But the other one is going to be, well, my son wants to go as Peppa Pig. So he's going to go as Peppa Pig for trick-or-treating.
Gotcha.
But then one of our costumes is going to be Drop Dead Gorgeous based.
See, this is really fun. This is sort of like Halloween is like kid Oscars because, you know, the Oscars, if you go to a bunch of different parties, often you might change outfits so that you don't appear in the same outfit everywhere,
yes.
Which is silly because people in life, we do just wear the same outfit for a whole night. But you know what? Maybe not it for the Oscars and maybe not for Halloween, aka Kid Oscar. So I'm totally on board with this.
No, my son hates it. And I'm like, listen, she clicks the camera 5 times. This is not torture. And it's like the only definite photo I have with my son all year. So I'm like, I'm going to do it.
That is fantastic. It's so fun. For me, it's fun to be talking to you about like being parents just because, I mean, I've known you for like 15 or 16 years. I feel
totally.
Like when Garfunkel and Oates started performing, Furman and I were still doing stuff at UCB.
Yes, you were.
And it was always really fun to see another comedy duo. And I have to tell you, and I know you know this because Mike helped produce a number of albums, but Mike and I were always like, holy shit, they write so much new stuff. Always like, I think that's what we're supposed to be doing. And we would go through these periods where we'd write a little bit if we got inspired and then nothing. And then we just wouldn't. And I would talk to, I feel like every 6 months I would talk to Furman. He's like, oh, I'm helping Ricky and Kate produce another. I'm like, how did they write that many new songs? And he goes, I don't know. It's amazing. So, you know, I'm excited to talk to you on the podcast for a lot of reasons.
Yes.
But also just like, I am so in awe of just your output is so incredible.
Oh my gosh.
That I would love to find out, like, what is your workflow? Like, how do you get yourself to sit down and make stuff the way you do?
Can I tell you, it's so depressing. Since becoming a mom, my workflow is 10 times slower. I thought it would be like...
So still 10 times more than the average person.
Right. So now I'm average. Well, like, yeah. I thought it would be like twice as slow or... It's so slow. It's just completely... Like, I haven't... So I used to have all these time management things and inspiration things. I set my whole life up to like make stuff and make it fun. And now my whole life is set up differently and I haven't figured out my new system. So I'm always like on TikTok looking like time management for moms, but... It's very different than, you know, someone who has to generate all their own stuff. I haven't seen like time management for self-generating moms.
Maybe this is an area that you could make videos about, or I would love to also pitch in on that because it is hard. And a lot of the reason is once everything is not all about you anymore, it's like your schedule and all of your energy is sort of wrapped around this wonderful little entity that can have a semblance of a schedule, but for the most part, you really kind of wrap everything around their schedule. And, you know, I don't know. Have you said publicly what your son's name is?
Yes, Keaton.
Okay, Keaton. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if I was, I'm always respectful of privacy.
No, thank you.
So, you know, for Keaton, I don't know if he's a schedule kid. Dimity is very much a schedule baby, but and she responds well to that, but even so, it still makes it a little more challenging to be like, oh yes, tomorrow I'm going to have an appointment from 1 to 2:30 because you just never know. Like, is she going to nap? What is going to come up? Is she going to need me? I fully just had to cancel a meeting yesterday because I went to leave and she was just like, daddy, please don't go. And I was like, well, I'm definitely not leaving because that's the sweetest. And she asked me to stay and I need her to know that I'm going to be there for her as much as possible. So I just rescheduled the meeting.
Yeah. And these are their core years of like feeling that building up that like thing of feeling safe and loved. It's like, now is the time for that. Like obviously always is the time, but like now, especially trying to make them feel like a consistency and a consistency when our lives are so inconsistent. So I think we're sort of faking consistency. Like, I never know when I'll get a job or not, or where I'll be going or what I'll be doing. And I'm sure you're the same way, where it's like, we have so little control over our schedules. And so we're like working overtime to make them feel like every day is the same. Every day is so easy. And
yeah, to give them structure and to give them a foundation and to give them stability. And I'm really curious to hear how you, where your head is at with this stuff, because I feel like you and I have very parallel kind of ambition goals where, you know, when we didn't have kids before, we were just like, 1,010% just focused on career and, you know, and visualization and manifesting and writing down lists and goals and, you know, stuff. And I don't want to say I'm not having a hard time with it, but what has changed for me is I guess I am having a hard time caring as much about the work stuff, because I'm like, I don't know if it doesn't feel as important to me anymore. So I'm so curious to know like where your head is at with that. And if you really have to push yourself to be like, no, this is still important. It's still good to do stuff.
Mine is so much sadder. I care just as much and I don't do it. So it's like, I feel like the chasm between what I want to be making and what I am making. And I feel it daily. Yeah. And I wish that wasn't the case. I wish I was like, now I have perspective. No, I don't. I have the exact same desire to make stuff all the time, but without quite the bandwidth to do it. So I'm still trying to like reconcile those pieces. Like, I know I would be happier if I could like be like, no, I'm in a different season, but I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm in the same season. And it's like,
yeah, but maybe you wouldn't be happier. Maybe you function the way you function. You know what I mean? Like maybe that, and I feel like that sort of high velocity, because what'll happen is eventually he'll go to school, you'll have chunks of time, and then you'll be able to, you know, redirect that. It's really the first few years where they're home all the time and you're focused on, you know, all the time, but you will start getting some of that time back. And it's refreshing to hear like you're still super motivated, because I sort of feel like on the other side of it, like, is there something wrong with me? Because it's like, oh, did I ever care about that stuff? You know what I mean? Like every day I know I barely fucking post anything anymore, because I'll go, oh, I should post something today. And then I'll go to breakfast and I'll try to like make a list and some goals or whatever. And I go home and we just hang out and we have fun and we'll, you know, go to the craft. We have a crafting table and we'll make crafts and we'll hang out or whatever. And it's like 5 o'clock and I'm like, well, now it's too late to post. It's like 8 o'clock on the East Coast. It's no one's going to see it. You know, I'll do it tomorrow. And then I just never get around to it. And I'm like, maybe I don't. Do I not care anymore about it? But I should.
I can see not caring about posting. That's hard. That's hard. Posting is like, it's relentless and I don't find much joy in posting. Like I find joy in creating things, but the actual posting of them, I don't find joy in. I'm like, oh God, okay. What's the ratio? And it all feels like busy work. And so I can see like not having joy in that, because I don't either.
Well, we grew up in a time where creative people were generally separate from marketers. And the generation of people who grow up now, who grew up with Instagram, TikTok, you know, self-generated engagement-based social media, you're just innately marketers and creators. And and whereas I feel like I constantly have to remind myself of that, and it fucking sucks, because I never wanted to be a marketer.
No.
That's not what I ever strived to be. And now it's like, oh my God, now I have to spot trends and figure out how to, because it's not just, it's, I mean, you did such a flawless job with No Worries If Not, your album, of making the videos and putting them out. And I really studied what you were doing. I'm like, I think that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Really? Oh my gosh. Thank you. Well, you know, what's funny is I really hadn't been paying attention to my social media that much, because I was more focused on the Garfunkel and Oates social media, because we really, you know, came up through YouTube. That was our whole thing. And so we put a lot of effort into that. And then when I was doing solo stuff, I was like, oh, I don't quite know what works for me. And I started kind of like testing things. And I basically got the unfortunate feedback that like big budget music videos were like the things people liked from me, or like not necessarily budget, but big thought out.
Yes.
Like, and I was like, oh darn. Cause I, you know, I was hoping it would be like me on my couch, like, hey, what's up? And it's not. That's like you know, just like swipe, swipe, swipe. But when I put out actual videos, that's what people seem to respond to. And I was like, okay, because all the wisdom online is like, no, you just talk now. It's authenticity. And I was like, I guess not for me. You know,
the funny one for me is watching people hold these lav mics like they're stick mics.
Yes.
And because that's the new signifier of like, hey, this is homegrown, or like it's just part of the visual dialect of like, oh, you hold and there's, I'm not throwing shade on that at all, because it's no different than holding a stick mic.
Yeah.
You know, you're just holding a lav. Mm-hmm. But I notice these things. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So that's sort of the, that's the signifier now. And I find the less, the things that I don't put any thought into do better. And the things that I really obsess over and every little detail are the things that just fall flat on their face. Like I've kind of just given
up. Sadly for me, it's the total opposite. It's such a bummer. When I put in all the effort, all the money, all the time, crushes.
You have dire and dancers like, and like some Victorian backdrop. And
totally.
Like,
and I'm like.
The lighting and the.
Yes.
We briefly pause to thank our sponsor for this episode of I Think You're Overthinking It, Manscaped, and their line of face shaving products. All right, I'm here to talk to you about the Handyman because it is a sleek, powerful, compact face shaver that I am all for. I have not used a straight razor, like a classic bladed razor has not dragged across my face in literally years. I don't like straight razors. They hurt me. And so I usually just am very, you know, scruffy, just really out of convenience. But the Handyman is got a dual blade system, all right? It's got a standard foil shaver and a long hair trimming blade to handle up to 3 days of beard growth, all right? And it's got skin-safe technology designed to help reduce nicks and cuts for the perfect clean shave. It is so right up your alley if you also do not like to use a straight razor and shaving cream. Also, it's waterproof, which makes cleanup a breeze. You just give it a rinse and you're done. And so compact, it's great for traveling or just like put it in a drawer. It barely takes up any room. And also 60 minutes of runtime per charge. So you're not gonna be scrambling to finish before the battery dies and then you're half shaved and have to figure out what to do because you're late for a meeting. All right, so join the over 12 million men who trust Manscaped and upgrade to the Handyman Rocket Man. You can use my code Hardwick for 15% off your entire order at manscaped.com. That's 15% off plus free shipping with the code Hardwick at manscaped.com. Don't miss out. Upgrade your grooming game with Manscaped today. And now we return to the podcast.
One thing that I've sort of felt that I reconciled with, where I said I haven't reconciled at all with my ambition, I have reconciled with not being young.
Yeah.
As far as like social media goes, like I see what people are doing. I see those things. And I'm like, no, I think it's okay to just be 46, not doing the latest, whatever. And it's fine. Because 17-year-olds aren't going to watch me anyway.
But what's ironic about that is by doing that, you actually are doing it the way that young people do it, which is authentically, you know, it's like we are authentically ourselves. I am a Gen Xer. I cannot change the fact that my idea of sketch comedy is kind of rooted in Kids in the Hall, where sketches have arcs and a lot of twists and escalate for like 6 or 7 or 8 minutes and in a very weird, surreal way. And so it's sort of, you know, I am also coming to terms with the fact of like, well, I am who I am. And if I try to pretend, it's why I really have had a hard time just like, oh, I'll dance in front of a green screen to some trending audio, because it's like, yeah, but I feel like that is so transparently not what I would do.
Yes.
And I feel like those times I've done that, it's never done well, because I feel like it's just not authentic.
No. And I'm so clearly at like a try hard. That like, yes, the things I try hard on are the things people like. Oh, they are, God. Like,
I love that you admit that, because I am also, but I feel like I have the opposite where it's like, you're trying hard. Like, I know.
And they're like, you're trying too hard. And I'm like, I tried so hard. Here you go. You know,
like, were you always like a big achiever, or did you have to kind of refocus yourself? Did you have some sort of an existential thing at some point in your life where I'm like, I need to fucking focus and like put my note, or were you always an achiever?
Well, I think I was like a achiever in high school, like straight A's and that kind of stuff. But like, I think the problem with that is it is like assignment based. So yes. I was used to someone giving me an assignment and me like meeting the assignment. and feeling good about that. And then once I had, like, out of high school, you have no assignments.
Right.
And you're like, I would have, like, you know, when my waitressing job, I would, like, you know, try to do good at that, but because that was kind of an assignment, I would have someone's order or whatever. But, like, as far as the creative career, I had no assignments, and I really had to, like, find a way to give them to myself and, like, you know, just generate it myself, which I think younger people are more used to this. They're used to the marketing and the self-generating, where we're sort of like an assignment generation.
Yeah, that's true, because we were sort of the last generation. I don't know if your parents were like this, but, and my parents were actually really cool about, like, me taking a creative career path. They were not traditional, like, boomer parents in the sense where they were like, you got to do one thing and it doesn't matter if you like it or not. You just got to do it for like 50 years. Then you can retire and try to enjoy whatever is left of your life. And so I think that was coming out of a generation where it was like, structure, fall in line, you know, go to work, bring a lunchbox, get a watch after 50 years. And I think the Gen Xers really started to rebel against that a little bit, especially.
And they should have, because the economy changed.
Yes.
And, you know, you could be a mailman and own your house.
Yes.
And that generation, and ours was like, wait, no. And the businesses people were doing were failing. There was like whole industries would move or fall apart. And so I think it was like, of course we rebelled.
And also, like, the ubiquity of cheap technology to be able, I mean, like, it's still, you know, when people go, oh, I want to start, you know, doing X, Y, or Z or making videos, what do I do? And as a cranky Gen Xer, sometimes I'm like, you have a fucking TV studio in your pocket. If I wanted to make videos in the 80s, I would either have to buy like a Hi8 camera, you know, like some VHS tapes. I would have to figure out how to edit them. I might have to edit them in camera. It would have the squiggle lines of the VHS. If I got it near a magnet, it was fucking ruined. Yep. You know, like and if you wanted film, then you had to, that was expensive and you had to get it developed and you had to know someone who could handle all that shit. And now it just seems like it's just all available. You know, I don't know.
I know. It is funny when people are like, I don't know what to do. I'm like, press record. Like, oh my God. Yeah. Even like the first time I made a short, it was so hard. And I, like, you know, I went through SAG. I got like a SAG waiver and I had to like I did all this stuff. It was so official and it was, you know, so expensive and time consuming and whatever. And then, you know, everything just got cheaper and easier.
Yeah. It definitely, the not only the technology, but the platforms. I mean, when we started, even if you did make a video, Furman and I would come up with dumb sketches all the time. And it's like, well, that's just never going to get made because where are we going to put that? You know? And I know people that would post like little QuickTime videos on their website that they made. They did their own HTML coding and it was like the size of a postage stamp. And maybe someone would trip over it as they were passing through the internet. But now it's just like, it's just a whole different game. And I really sometimes struggle to be like, yeah, I'm all in, and like, I don't know, maybe it's
like easier and harder. It's easier to make stuff, but harder because there's more competition. Like when we started on YouTube, it was in 2007, and there was like, we would get featured on the front page all the time because there wasn't that many people.
And also a human was curating the homepage at that time, and yes, Everyone had the same homepage. Mm-hmm. And then I hope this is accurate information. I apologize if it's not. But my understanding is that when Google bought YouTube, it became algorithmic, you know, because they were in service to the algorithm and, you know, whatever that is. And so then it all changed and eventually people got their own personalized homepage, you know, engagement or whatever. But it really wasn't that different than how radio used to be programmed, where humans would go, oh, I saw this really cool thing. And so you got this like wide berth of different things that weren't necessarily things you would already like, which I think is what the algorithm tends to do. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you start posting on YouTube 2 years when YouTube's 2 years old.
Yes.
What a fun time to mm-hmm. really be like breaking through then.
Yeah. That was like, I remember when we were posting, it was to the point where like my team back then was like, you can't put stuff on the internet. They'll never let you be on TV. They're like, you're going to ruin your career. I did this web series that I loved called Girl Trash. I read it and I was like, oh my gosh, I love it. And it was like, and they were like, don't do it. You'll never book a pilot again. This will be like the internet was like the death of a career. And I, but even like, I just didn't listen because I actually just knew they were wrong. I was like, I don't understand why that would be that. Like, I'm not famous. I'm not anybody. Like, it doesn't, no one's looking at me. I can do whatever I want. You know what I mean? Like, you, I was anonymous. I can, no one's going to penalize me.
So silly. I think that was coming out of old media thinking, the way that network people used to perceive cable. Well, mm-hmm. you can't do a cable series because that's garbage.
Right.
And you know, when I started on MTV, well, if you work on MTV, you can't work anywhere else because no one will take you seriously. And then all of a sudden, because people had this perception of cable, what ends up happening? Well, the really cool people who are getting rejected by network television go and work for very little money on cable, but they do these wildly creative things. Mm-hmm. A la the, what happened with the YouTube and the internet. And it's like, okay, well, the creative people will just find a way because they're edged out of these other things that are gatekept by people who are, you know, who don't think creatively necessarily in that way. Yeah. They think about the largest audience as quickly as possible. And we've our creative landscape has really nichified, but it's really swung in the opposite direction where it's so niche where it's like, oh man, like I can have no awareness of any of the things that are influencing you. Whereas yes. we were growing up, we were all kind of influenced by roughly the same things.
One of the best parts about being niche is I feel like I get less mean comments because I'm more presented to people who would be inclined to like me. And oh, I was like, really oh, good.
Yeah.
I still get a lot. Like if you, the more successful video, the more I get, you know, I still get them, but like, it's not as bad.
It's, well, yeah, because I guess if it is feeding it to people who would already like you, then they're already going to like you. But yes. I really would love to talk through your process because I remember we had a series of phone conversations because we were both starting to write solo stuff around the same time. And I had never really written solo stuff without Furman. And I think you were in a similar situation where you were like coming
so
out
of hard
Garfunkel
for me.
Notes.
It was so hard for me. I really, to this day, I'm like, I miss the slumber party vibe of writing with someone else. Like it's just more fun.
Yeah.
It's just more fun. And I'm just like still trying to find joy in it alone. And it's harder. It's harder. It's just not as fun.
Well, yeah, because when you get that writer's room mentality where you can like dogpile jokes on, oh, this, and then you're just yes-anding each other. Yes. And then when you're laughing really hard, you're like, okay, I think this is something we should explore. Or also having a sounding board. When the joke in your head, the audience is laughing hysterically, but someone else is like, oh, I don't know if any, I'm not sure that's going to land the way you think it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Okay. Thank you. I wasn't sure.
Let's top it. Let's.
Yeah.
Or I love when like someone says the worst suggestion, but then it leads to the best thing.
Yes.
Like that is the best. When we all just have bad ideas, and then it leads to like the amazing idea. And it's like, oh, it's the best feeling.
It is, because that's allowing yourself to suck at something and knowing that you're generating something. But again, having that other person there to help you sculpt that. And when you're alone, you're like, I don't know anybody. Oh, it's just me. Is this funny? You know, and
because I remember you had just learned to play the piano too.
I had
not that long ago.
No.
Yeah. I remember running into you at that birthday party and you were doing piano lessons. You were starting solo stuff. I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of had to learn how to play piano and guitar in front of audiences, and they were very kind and forgiving about it because I was very upfront about like, hey, you just paid to watch a guy learn to play piano, and they were fine with it. You know, as long as I was upfront about it.
Right. And they're there to laugh. They're not there for a piano recital.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Yeah.
I always say like, I just need to be good enough at guitar for a comedy club, not to play a bluegrass festival. You know what I mean? Like I just want to be good enough so that all the non-musicians in the audience can go, oh, that's slightly better than I could do. I'm on board.
It's fine. I used to feel that way about singing because I was always singing in a duo. And now I'm like, oh, I got to get better at this. So I've been in singing lessons for the last 2 years, like intensely, like, I was like, oh, this isn't alone. This is not cutting it. This is not it.
And that's so funny to hear you say that because, you know, Furman is a master musician. I mean, that guy can play every instrument. He can work out any song. This fucking guy, when we were in college, came back one week, like after Thanksgiving holiday, playing Maple Leaf Rag, which is a very hard song to play. He was like, oh, I learned this over the Thanksgiving holiday. He does not read sheet music.
He's brilliant.
He's brilliant. And also like, he can just hear what a harmony should be and come right in. So he instantly elevates what I'm doing. You know, I always felt very, and of course, Mike is the nicest in the world. So yes. I always felt very insecure about like, I'm sorry, I'm not really bringing him. And he's like, dude, it's fine. It's fine. But you're absolutely right. When you don't have that other voice there, that other person or that other guitar, you're like, oh boy.
No. Oh my God. And so we never even did harmony. Everything was in unison. And Mike and I would sit there and edit unison vocals. And we would have to like, and I know like that was the worst part about working with me. I know it because we would have to like, if Kate and I would pronounce a vowel differently, we had to like, I would go and like re-sing that vowel in like my Kate impression. And we'd have to like make it because it would sound weird because unison has ADR to be perfect. For Kate. Yeah. I would change her vowel. Like it would just be the teeniest little one tiny thing or, but we'd have to like move a T or we'd have to, you know, it had to be in sync. And it was definitely the worst part about working with us. And Mike was awesome and patient, but we would both be like, okay, vocal editing day, here we go. And it was just like constant. It was,
yeah,
but I know he'd be like, oh God. And I was such a perfectionist. I know he would just be like, okay.
I know, but hearing it, but knowing that you're a perfectionist in that way and so attentive to every molecular detail, the other amazing thing about your workflow is that you do it, you do finish. You know what I mean? Yes. Like it is so easy to get caught up in the spiral of stuck in perfectionism, whatever mm-hmm. that means. And not finishing, but you still manage to finish and you still manage to put out a tremendous amount of stuff. So how do you reconcile that? How do you allow yourself to be done with something? Is there a certain feeling or do you just like, all right, I can't do this anymore. Or I'll never put it out.
It's not, I can't do this anymore. It's like, I will, cause I'll have a song and it'll be too long and not quite it, but I'm like, okay, I can take it and do it live. So I do it at a like small comedy club. I'll do it in a parking lot. I'll find like the smallest, lowest stake shows and it'll give me feedback and I'll see what's working and what's not working. So I'll play it a bunch of times, the too long version. And then I'll like, okay, I'll cut this, cut that, cut this. And I'll mold it with an audience. So with a low stakes audience or just, you know, so then that's how I find it. And then when I've got it tight, where like, I know where the punchlines are hitting, then I'll be like, okay, now I can record it.
Oh my God. That's so amazing. I mean, literally since we first started talking about doing solo stuff, I've recorded a ton of songs. I still haven't put them out in the same amount of time. You made a bunch of songs, made a bunch of videos, put out an album, self-released an album, mm-hmm. wrote a one-person show, put on the one-person show at Edinburgh and all these places. And I am constantly just in awe of you because it's, you know, it's so inspiring to see like, yes, this is what you're supposed to be doing. This is you make the thing and then you take the thing out and mm-hmm. you have to be comfortable with it for a while, not being exactly what you want. But eventually, if you have faith in yourself, you'll just figure it out.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's so much easier to have faith as a group.
Of course. Because
you can take the hits as a group. And so it was like I had to really walk through that fire myself to be like, I am enough. It was like a couple years of me not making a single thing, wanting to, but not doing it because I just didn't have the confidence. And I just had to get over it. I just had to get over it. And at some point I was like, okay, I can't, like, am I just never going to make anything again? Like, what am I scared of? Like, I already have a million people online telling me how unfunny I am. Is that what I'm scared of? That it'll be 2 million? Like, it's fine. Like, I had to get over it. And like, part of it was like talking to my husband, because he was, you know, he's just very zen about stuff. He's very zen about bombing and trying things. And he's kind of unflappable in this way that I found very inspiring. And I could never fully be that. I mean, nor do I want to, because that's not who I am. But like, I'm like, no, I can, what's going to happen? Like, what's the worst? Like, what's, yeah, you know, it'll be fine.
I think also if you're able to recognize it as just part of the process rather than necessarily the ultimate end goal mm-hmm. of like, and then I put it out, you know, it's like, well, that's part of the process. I mean, the birthday party you're talking about was Rob Zombie. Mm-hmm. And I've always admired Rob because he just is a tireless generator, self-generator. Yeah. And he realized pretty early on, he just didn't want to work at other people's directions. So he started releasing his own albums and making his own movies and being, you know, like, and kind of creating this workflow of like, write an album, record an album, tour an album, write a movie, direct a movie, put out a movie, write an album, record an album. And so it's, you know, what I love about when you, and you seem to do the same kind of thing, is that each release is really not, it's just part of the next step before the next step, before the next step, before the next step. And that makes it process oriented as opposed to, and when you're goal oriented, it's so much easier to get caught up in, oh, if I put this out, are people going to shit on it? Or is it not going to work? Or man, what if I never write again? You know, it's like, right. Well, now you're just not going to do anything then.
Getting caught up in that. Yeah. It's really hard to quiet those voices. Some people don't really have those. They don't have that inner critic. And in a way, I think I wouldn't want that either. Because then you just like put out, you're not growing.
Right.
You're just putting out whatever. You're not like, so I'm like, what's the balance between that side of your brain that goes, that's not good enough, that's garbage, and the side that's like going, make stuff, be confident, put it out there. Like, what's the marriage of that? Because it's like, you want to like elevate each time or evolve in some way. You don't just want to be like, here's another thing. Here's another, you know, like, like that I find uninteresting. And you can tell when people are in a mode like that.
Yeah. You ever meet someone without an internal monologue and they don't know what you're talking? You're like, oh, you know, you got that voice in your head that just tells you like, you know, everything you're doing could suck and you're not really sure. And then every choice you make, well, you probably should have done something else. And they're like, what do you mean? Well, you know, I just mean like, you know, the voice that's like, oh, you should have done it this way. And then this would have gone this way. And then if you had told this joke and then that, I don't know. I just made a thing. What? I don't, what? What? It's like, you literally can't understand each other.
No, we're just like different species. And like when I was doing my show in DC every day, I had to like calm myself down. I had to get myself, I never got to the point where it was easy. Never once. I never got to a point where I was confident. I had to like every day do a full like mental reset. Like I'm still not used to being alone. I'm just like forcing myself to do it because I love making stuff.
And that's the only way to do it is just to go put it out in the world.
Here we go. Yeah. Here. And the doing my show in Edinburgh was, it was amazing because I had like, you know, when someone says something to you that like is just right. And then you're like, I have to like build my life around this piece of advice. Do you know, do you ever have that? Like,
yes,
it's still
please,
rare.
Whatever you're about to say, I really want to hear it because
it's
I'm
so
ready for that.
Rare when someone says the exact thing and you're like, well, now I have to change what I'm doing now. And I had told my friend Brian McElhenney about this fertility musical idea. We were like at a bar in New York and we'd gone to a Broadway show and I was like, I want to make a show. And he was like, you should do it. I'm going to direct it. And I was like, okay. And we just said it like la-di-da. Like it was like, I didn't even have any ideas. And then like a month later, he was doing his show in Edinburgh and he texted me and he goes, this is where you need to do your show. 1 year from today, we're bringing Dead Inside to Edinburgh. I had not written a song. And I was like, yep. Yep. And it felt like just like a blessing. It felt like a gift. I was like, that is the exact thing. I was a little stalled and whatever. And I was like, and it just changed it for me. And I was like, okay, I have 1 year. I'm going to get on stage. I'm going to start performing. I'd never performed alone. I'd never done any of this. And I was like, here we go. Because a year felt like enough time.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then like the next day I like got up and I started writing it and I was like, here we go. So and it was just like nice to have somebody say the exact right thing.
Well, and the timing of that was really good too, because Edinburgh sort of feels like, and I've always thought about doing Edinburgh, but then I kind of go like, I don't know, maybe I should have done that like 20 years ago, because I know that it's like, you're doing a show every night for a month.
Yep.
You're out on the street flyering yourself. You're getting people to shows. Sometimes two people show up. Sometimes 200 people show up.
Yep.
You never know. But again, it seems like what an amazing way to perfect and sculpt a show of having to do it that many times for mm-hmm. a variety of audiences.
Totally. And I just had this, when he said that, like all these things kind of clicked into place because I was so stuck. I wasn't making anything. And I was like, oh, I've done this before. I can do it again. I've built something from the ground up before. I know how to do it. I've just been kind of in a different mode. I'd been more coddled where I had people helping me and like, and I was like, no, I'm back at the start. no one's helping me. I need to do it all. Like, I need to learn how to do graphics again. I need to learn how to, like, I need to, the way that at the beginning of Garfunkel Notes, we built it for ourselves. Nobody told us to put stuff on YouTube. Nobody told us anything. And we just like tried stuff and built it. And I was like, oh, that's where I am again. That's so, in a way, depressing. But a lot of people, you know, find themselves in a new chapter and you're like, no, I'm at the beginning again. I'm bottom floor. I need to start figuring all this stuff out for myself.
But that's got to be exciting because it is fun to learn. It is fun to grow. It's fun to feel like you're evolving, right?
Mm-hmm. And be like, who am I? As like, I didn't know what I was doing then. And I was like, I can figure it out. I've done it before. I can do it again. That's the best part about making something is then you get that confidence to go, oh, I already did this. I can do this again. I can push it up a hill. I can make it happen. I can get it out there. And you've made so many things. Like, I'm sure that, like, you know, you can tap into that piece of you. That's like,
yeah. I mean, all the stuff that I've made in the last few years has really just been as part of like a music education program that I crafted for myself, you know, with the help of a really great producer who knows everything about music and music theory and plays. He's very much like Furman. Mm-hmm. It really is just like, oh, I'm making stuff just for me, which I've never done before. I never thought I'd put it out. And that changed the dynamic of how I was thinking about things because it removed the filter of like, oh, no one's going to think that funny. It's like, well, I don't fucking care because I'm never going to release this. So I'm just making this for me. What a fun learning process. Mm-hmm. But then when I amassed enough of them and I was like, man, maybe I should put these out. And I still haven't. But
what do you think it is? What do you think is the, do you think it's that it's not ready? Or do you think that,
I know exactly what it is.
What is it?
It's result-oriented thinking, right? Because it's been so fun to make all these things and manifest all these different styles of songs and genres that I wanted to learn and music production and, you know, playing instruments on some of them. And I recorded a cover of the Haunted Mansion theme, Grim Grinning Ghost, where I played every instrument and did every voice just to see if I could do it.
That's
and
amazing.
I never put it out. And I think I know the reason is this. It's self-sabotage because I go, it's been so fun up to now. And once I release it, it's not really mine anymore. And then it may cease to be fun. And then I'm going to be pissed that I soiled the experience by putting it out and having people say, well, this isn't good or it sucks. Or worse, that it's just so boring that it has no effect on anything. And then I have to go, God damn it, this was so fun before. And now I'm, you know, but you know, that's why it's really helpful to talk to you because it reminds me of like, it's just a step in the process. And for anyone listening, it's like, don't think about the result. Mm-mm. The goal should just be to keep going. That's your fucking goal. Your goal isn't to put out any one thing. It's like, it's another step along the way. When you do that, you start over and you do it again and you do it again and you do it again.
You should put it out on Halloween.
I might.
Right? Like, can you get a video together before then? Like, that's so fun.
What, for the Haunted Mansion theme?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I already thought about what it would be. It would probably just be me and like different makeup singing the different vocal tracks, but you know, like lip syncing the different vocal tracks. But you know, it, but again, I may or may not do it. And again, it's so easy to get distracted and go, yeah, but I was being a dad all day today. So I didn't, you know, it is, as much as I love being a dad, it's also an incredibly convenient excuse for me not to do
stuff. Oh, completely. Completely. So, yeah. It's funny. You're making me feel like I'm productive. Cause in my mind, I feel like I'm not.
No. You're extraordinarily productive.
So much slower than I used to be where I'm just like, I feel so much foggier cause I'm on someone else's biorhythms all the time. Like I'm on his schedule and his sleep schedule and it's, yeah.
Yeah, but you're just, that's why I was kind of joking, like your output is still more than like the average person, but it's just less than what you're used to.
Yes.
So it might feel like a different speed, but I can tell you as your friend and an outside observer, you've put out in a lot of incredible stuff and not just like stuff, like really incredible stuff. Like the music videos are so well choreographed and shot and I saw them like blow up and you know, the one person show, it's so wonderful to see your evolution and to see like, oh, the same person that co-wrote The Loophole wrote this deeply personal show about, you know, deeply personal struggles with fertility.
Yeah.
And, you know, did that feel like an evolution to you? Did that feel
challenging? Well, it did. Like when I was going solo, I was like, okay, you know, instead of focusing on the disadvantages, which I had been focusing on, like, it's not as fun, it's scary, whatever. I was like, what are the advantages? And I was like, oh, the advantages are that I can tell the things that only happened to me. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like telling something from a point of view of two people when it only happened to one of them is like disingenuous. It'd be weird. You know, it didn't, you know, Kay was very fortunate and she had a baby naturally. And, you know, so it would have been strange to tell that story as a duo. And I was like, okay, so that's the advantage, is I can actually just tell things that are only true for me. And they're true for a lot of other women. I just meant, but out of the two of us, that it was just true for me. And I was like, and I knew I was going to get a lot of backlash for it. I knew I would. And I was just like, am I okay with that? And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And I just tell everything. I had a surrogate. I had a lot of fertility trauma. And I'm like, I think it is fine. I think this is for the people. It's for certain people. And it's not, that's why I call the album No Worries If Not. 'Cause I'm like, if it's not for you, that's fine. I'm going to tell, like, it's for certain people. It's not for other, it's not a crowd pleaser. You know, it's about like aging and finding your new identity. And like, you know, when something you really want is like not working out, and just like, how do you like just getting through that, like step by step by step, and like all the, you know, how do I make this funny? And I was like, oh, it is, there are so many funny things that happen. So I was like, okay, I'm going to make it funny. I'm just going to do it and see who finds it. And if people didn't like it, I guess I'd be fine. I'd live with it. You know, no worries if not. Yeah.
But the people that it did connect with, I imagine it was so incredible to them to have someone speaking on their behalf in a way that, you know, that was that they were able to identify with, and someone that understood, you know, I mean, it really is incredible. And going to, you know, I remember Mike Birbiglia kind of changed my perspective on comedy writing many years ago, because he said, go to a place where you're uncomfortable and then write from there. And I'm like, oh my God, that's incredible, because that is by default going to be personal. Mm-hmm. So it will connect with some number of people, but
yeah,
and the people that doesn't, it's fine, but the people that it does, it will really, really be meaningful to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had that experience. I've had so many conversations, well, with women and men. I was going to say with women, but with men too, because they, you know, it doesn't happen to their bodies, but it's happening to them. They're, you know, not, they're having fertility trauma as well. And so I've had so many amazing, I actually just got a card yesterday from someone who'd seen the show in DC, and she sent me just this very intimate, like, thank you note. And it was really like moving.
So is the plan to continue to tour that show?
Yes, I'm trying. Theater is kind of glacial paced in a way that I'm not used to. Like, it's a slower business than Hollywood. And so we're trying to figure out the next theater. We're trying to like figure out where to take it, but I'm very excited. I just can't wait to do it again. I want to do it in New York. I want to do it in other cities. I want to just keep sharing it.
What was the biggest lesson that you learned from doing the show in Edinburgh?
This is going to sound really sad. This is going to sound sad. That I'm not unlikable.
Oh my gosh, Ricky. Of course you're not. Oh my God.
No, I'll cry. But I really,
That like my heart, you are so incredibly likable and amazing, like that. And I think that speaks, oh my God.
But isn't it funny? We tell ourselves these stories. We tell ourselves things, and we let certain things in and not other things. And it forms a false identity that isn't true. And it was so clear to me that was not the case by like the second show. I was like, oh, it's like, it's fine.
You know, the number of people who are listening to this that probably, and myself included, stop themselves from putting themselves out there, from pursuing the things that they want, because they have these mental barriers where they say, well, I can't do this, or I'm unlikable, or no one's going to, it just isn't. And, you know, the quotation mark simple, not so simple secret from your example is like, you know what? You fucking do it anyway. You do it anyway. And it doesn't matter what it doesn't like those self-sabotaging voices that are probably left over from childhood or whatever it is, or trauma or whatever it is. You don't have to listen to them. You don't have to be ruled by them.
No.
And it breaks my heart and makes me so happy to hear that, you know, I'm sorry that you ever had that thought that, but I'm so happy that you arrived at that it wasn't true. It was just a fucking story you were telling
it
yourself.
It was just a story
reason.
That I like wasn't enough on my own. I wasn't likable. I wasn't lovable. I was like too harsh. I was too something but in whatever way it wasn't, it was unlikable though was the big thing. And I was like, wow, and then I realized it wasn't true.
So from after the second show, so shows 3 through 30, did that change your presentation of the show?
Yes.
Did you feel like a weight had been lifted, and how did that change the way that you were presenting the material?
I think I like locked in more. I just locked in and I was able to like, I think I was so fast in the beginning. I was just telling the story so fast and getting through it and trying to like get off stage. And I allowed myself to slow down a little bit and like actually take a set, like, and I still talk really fast as like a natural pace for me, but I had to, like, I allowed myself to like sit with it more, like really tell the story instead of like performing it correctly and remembering the lines. I was like, I allowed myself that experience more to like have a communal experience with the audience where like we're having a thing together, like, and it was actually started to be fun. Even though I was terrified every day, it started to be fun.
You know, that
if you were going to do a one person show, what would it be?
Like if I were going to have like a story arc?
Yeah.
It's interesting because I'm looking at shooting my next comedy special, which is really like sort of two things. It's a bit of the set that was pre me doing instruments and half of it's musical. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it has to do, you know, it's just a lot of the stuff that every comedian of my generation is coping with is just middle age. You know what I mean? Like in my, I shot like a pilot of the special just to see how it looked. Like I shot it at a comedy club last year at Acme in Minneapolis, just to see what it looked like, like story wise. And I call it the middle ages because it's just really, I started so many things in middle age. I started guitar, piano. I started, you know, Italian. I became a dad. I got married in middle age, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
Me too. It sounds like we had a similar thing where it's like, there's like a start over.
It was a bit of a start over.
Yeah. There's like a restart, but yeah, it sounds like we had a similar path where I think you had, you know, you're like, no one's going to play this music for me. I'm going to learn it myself.
Yeah. And it really was just sort of the, like, can I do it? You know? Yeah. And then it took so many shows before it actually got fun. And I wasn't thinking about my hands, kind of like what you're saying about like, oh, once when you're trying to learn something, you're in that mode. I think this is what you were saying of like just getting through it where you're, and you get through it really fast because you just want to be done. You just want to get through it as quickly as possible. And then you start, you can step back and really start to enjoy it. You know, my trainer always had this thing where he would say line speed beauty, where it's like you have to learn the line of something. And he applied it to boxing, but you would learn the line of something and then you could do it fast, competently. And then once you learn how to do that, then you could make it beautiful and artistic, you know?
Whoa, that's great. I love that.
Yeah. So it just takes a little bit of time. But so I think that's sort of what it would be. It would just sort of, it's just kind of an exploration of like, hey, I started all these things in middle age. You can too. Like I always want to cheer people on and I always want to let them know, like, you know, I'm not particularly talented. I just had some consistency with piano and guitar. You know, I had some free time during the pandemic. So that's what I focused on to keep me from, you know, being too anxious. And, cause you can't focus on anything else when you're learning a fucking instrument.
No, it is like, wow, it's hard. I also started taking, I've always played piano a little bit, but I took piano lessons before Edinburgh so I could move like more, just, I wanted to be more competent on the instrument. I'm still just competent, but I'm competent enough. But it, man, learning piano is, it sucks. Practicing every day is so hard.
It's hard. And so I also know that when I put this, that when I eventually do shoot this and put it out, look, I'm not the greatest guitar player in the world. I'm not the greatest vocalist or piano player in the world. And so I'm in my mind, I'm already dealing with the criticism of stuff that hasn't even happened yet, where it's like, oh, this isn't as good as these other comedians where music is their bag. And it's like, I'm just getting to the point where I'm like, yeah, I know, but I'm really kind of doing it just to see if I can do it. It's really just a stop along the way of kind of, you know, artistic development. And I think starting things in middle age take a lot of the pressure off of having to be great at it. It's like, well, I didn't start as a kid. I'm never going to be a prodigy at this. I'm better than I ever thought I would be. And I think that's good enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the talent stack theory.
Now, what's that?
Well, it's like, so you might be, you know, a B plus at piano and a B plus at, well, you're like an A at singing, but like, we'll just say a person, they're a B plus at this, and they're a B plus at that, and they're a B plus at, but then when you add it up, it's like an awesome show.
Oh, interesting. Oh, well, that's a really good way to think about it.
It's I feel that way about myself. Like, I mean, there's people who are better actors, people who are better singers, or people who better, but when I fuse everything I can do into one thing, I'm like, oh, that's pretty good, I think, you know?
I would love to talk to you about you and I have talked a little bit about this, but the self-release of the album, because it does sort of seem like, you know, and not to, I mean, I just don't know that world very well, but, you know, would it have been any better if you had gone with a label? I don't think so. I mean, it's like, I don't know what else would have happened, you know?
So, you know, I've never done a record label. We met with all these record labels when we started Garfunkel & Oates, and they all had these offers, and the offers all seemed so bad. I was like trying to, I felt like there was something I was missing. Cause I was just like, okay, but, and I would have these questions and they're like, no, it's just, it's the, and I was like, well, they'd be like truly the offers were like, we'll give you $5,000 advance to make the album. It would be some like that where you're like, okay. And then they're like, and then after that, all the profits are 50-50. And I'm like,
after they make the 5,000, after they make the money back.
Yeah. But then I was like, but then what is your role? And they're like, oh, well, we'll market it. And I was like, how? And they're like, you know, and they start saying stuff. And I was like, is that in writing? And they're like, and I was just honestly asking, and they were like, well, no. And I was like, so wait, hang on. And then I was like, who owns it? And they're like, well, we do. And I'm like, so if I say had a TV show, I'd have to license the songs from you. Or what if we wanted to use it in a Broadway musical? We'd have to ask you. And what happens if, like, all my questions, like, it just seemed like so you give me $5,000 and then I give it back.
and then I give you everything
I own. And then I have to take your word that you're giving me the 50% after all of your expenses. I couldn't work it out in my head. I was like,
yes, that's $5,000 gross. Was that $5,000 each or $5,000 to split?
Oh, to split.
Okay. So you each get $2,500 gross. But when you take taxes out of that, if you pay any commissions or whatever, what you're really talking about is like $1,000.
And each. That's how much was to make the album. And I said, what if the album costs more? Because it will. And they're like, well, then that's something you incur.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And I was like, who would take this deal? And then I would just, everyone I went to, we had so many meetings and everyone I felt like weirder about.
Everyone has the ability to market themselves now on all of the platforms.
But this was in 2007. But the thing was, they were offering us the same deal as a stand-up album. And I was like, right, because they don't need to, stand-up comedians don't need to own those words. They're not going to do anything with them. They're not, do you know what I mean? Like they were offering, we're like, these are songs. Like, yeah. So I've been self-releasing the whole time.
Oh my God. That's so interesting because it, I don't think when Mike and I put our album in 2005, and I think we did it through, Comedy Central Records, but I'm not sure that any money is like, they just put it out, but that was literally the same year YouTube came out. And so I think we were just like, well, I don't know what we would do to market. Like, what are we going to do if we just do it ourselves in 2005? You know, are we just like loading up our car with CDs and just driving around the country and jumping up? It's like, I didn't know.
That's what we did. We have these pictures of us putting the CDs into the cases, signing them all, like We did everything.
We tried to do that. And when Rodeohead came out in like 2005, we made this bluegrass medley of Radiohead songs. It went viral. Viral for, you know, then. It was like, it got downloaded like a million times. I mean, we had to pay for the bandwidth because we couldn't hope we had to host it.
Yeah.
And so we were like, oh my God, a million. This was old media thinking. So we're like, okay, we had a show in Texas and Austin after this happened. So we're like, shit, do we bring 120 CDs? Is that enough? Should we bring like 200? So we filled our suitcases. We left out clothing. You know, it's like we brought minimal changes of clothing, filled our CD, our suitcases with CDs, and then sold like two. You know, it was like, oh, fuck. It was like, we totally did not. We missed the mark on that.
Damn, that's funny. We always did pretty well with the merch.
Oh, that's cool.
That would seem like, but it was really homegrown. Yeah. It was the same thing where, well, also these record companies were like, you could buy CDs from us for $4 a CD. And we're like, what do you mean? Like, we can't just manufacture them. We can't just make, yeah, just, yeah. So self-releasing was like, not even a question. And it's easy. It's easy to do. I mean, you have to be like the quality control police all the way through, you know, because no one's helping you, you know, but you know, you get good people and you get good mastering and you get, you know. And then I used a different distributor this time. And so I literally had a friend who's like younger, who's released through them, sit with me to make sure I wasn't clicking some weird thing. Like I was like, and like now I know how to do it, but I hired someone to sit with me as I uploaded. So that I wasn't going to fumble it on the 1 yard line. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to make this whole thing and then fumble it at the end.
Yeah.
So I just paid someone to sit there with me and watch it upload.
But now you know how to do it.
Yes.
Have you ever, the process, is it, because there is some thinking around the idea of like, don't release albums anymore, release singles because people don't care about albums anymore. And I saw your post about like, hey, if anyone out there is voting for Grammys, I got an album. And it's like, oh yeah, you should get nominated for a Grammy because the album is a fucking amazing achievement. Besides just being good, it's like you really did it. It really deserves to be nominated. I mean, I have nothing to do with that world.
Thank you.
But in as much, if anyone right now is listening to this that has any sway,
are you in the Academy? Do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. This is the first album where I used all live instruments. So we like really, me and my producers, we hired like all live stuff. And like, part of it was like doing it, like trying stuff out. Cause it's hard to know when you're a solo person, it's hard to know what instruments will work. So part of it is like trying it out in MIDI and then like bringing someone in to do the trumpet or like, yeah. Anytime you hear, yeah, it's, I think, yeah. I'll even there's like recorders live, like everything.
So what was just for anyone who's kind of thinking about like self-releasing, you know, myself included, what were some of the things that you learned throughout the process from, you know, from A to B to C to D in terms of like, you have your tracks, you have them mastered, you're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now what happens?
So I was watching a lot of like YouTube videos on how to do stuff. And I don't think I was that great at this release thing. Like I it just wasn't my forte. So I was like, I kind of would like promote a song at a time when I had the video, which I know is not the way to do it. I know you're supposed to have a big out, you're supposed to have a listening party and all these things. And I had just come back from Edinburgh. I was just kind of like, oh, I don't know. And so I kind of just put it out there and then, yeah, I just like wouldn't do it the way I did it. Like if I did it again, I would probably have more planning. I would have videos leading up to it. I would make it more of an event, but this was just a learning curve as far as putting it out. I changed the date 3 times because it wasn't done. You know, I am such a perfectionist that I'll hear, there was one song, it was fully mastered, ready to go. And I heard a weird breath and I was like, I can't, we got to take it out. And I got it.
That'd be crazy.
We had to go. I was like, I just can't. And so we had to take it out. We took it down, you know, we took out the breath and then I had to get it remastered. I paid to you know, and then you get the new codes and sadly, I feel like I would love like a coach for that. Cause I was just making it up. I was just like, I'm going to do it on April 4th. And I did. I didn't have any strategy.
I think we're past it. I mean, what it seems to me is that we're past a time where, like, if I release an album, no one's going to care if it's like, oh, I'm going to release it on this. You know, it's like, I think I actually would say you did it the right way because you just put the material out there. Yeah. You know, you didn't burn cycles on telling people like, I'm going to, you know, there is some thinking about the modern state of releasing, which is, but if you tell people about stuff that's not available to them yet, people are such voracious consumers that they're going to be like kind of resentful. Like, yeah, but I want the thing, you know, and that you could burn cycles.
Well, part of it's shyness. Like I have a really hard time with like talking to the camera. I can't seem to break that thing. I can't seem to like do those videos. I've tried and I'm like, this is terrible. So I can't seem to like be like, I have an album coming out. I'm like, I feel so self-conscious. I can't, I don't know why I haven't broken that barrier yet. I want to challenge myself to do it with my next album, but this one I was just like, here's graphics. I just got a lot of good graphic people.
Yeah. I think it's just because we feel weird being salespeople.
Yeah.
It's just, it feels weird. Like it's one thing to make a thing, but then when you have to be a salesman about your thing, it just feels weird. It feels weird because I don't like to bother people. I feel, you know, and it, like, that's why I love the title, No Worries If Not, because that's so in the vein of how I present things. Like, I'm not asking you to like this. You don't have, it's no big deal. Right. I'm just going to set it here. And it, you know what? This probably sucks. I'm going to take it back. You know? So it's just that idea of like not wanting to make anyone feel obligated, not trying to, you know, in a world where people are getting sold to constantly.
Smash that like button.
Yes.
Follow and subscribe. But like, no,
smash
I can't.
That like button.
Literally.
And again, and no shade on that because that works for people. And it is a dialect that people understand.
Yes.
I just feel weird about it for me. I feel weird asking people for help. I feel weird asking people to like my thing. And so it creates maybe this vibe of like, oh, is he not as into the thing he's doing? Because I am so codependent about like, no, it's fine. You don't have to.
It's fine. It doesn't matter. Yeah. No worries if not. But the one thing that was kind of cool was I had, you know, we'd made so many videos before that I had all these talented people I knew. And I just was like, you know, for the first video for Don't Google Mommy, I worked with these guys, the Shy Kids, who had made videos for Garfunkel & Oates.
Yeah.
So they're these awesome guys out of Toronto, and they had worked with us before. So I was like, hey, do you want to do this thing you do? And then we planned this thing and it was awesome. And then for Middle Age Love, I called my choreographer, Kat Burns, who I've worked with for 15 years. And I was like, want to make a thing? And she was like, yeah. And she like came to my apartment. We always had the same routine. She would come to my place. We do wine and sushi. And then we just start playing around and laughing and finding a thing. And we just did that. And then it was like, okay, great. And then, you know, Kat has just this stable of amazing dancers. And I told her what I was looking for. So she cast it perfect. And then the DP from another period DP'd it. And it was sort of, you know, so it was like, it was fun. And I had Fred B a cameo in it. I was like, do you want to play saxophone? And he's like, yeah. Cause he drummed on the track, but we didn't have a drummer in it. So, but we did have a saxophone. And then my producers, we were just going to work on one little thing. We were like, let's just try this one. Cause I was making all this stuff during the pandemic and I worked with them on a demo and it was fun. And then I was like, oh, let's just see. And then it really went well. And so then we just like kept going, and then we're like, okay, we're just going to make the whole album, and then we just kind of did.
This is maybe a weird question, but do you feel accomplished?
Not really.
Oh man,
not particularly. No,
I look, it's not my business. My desire for you is to recognize the amount of stuff that you've generated just because you got yourself to do it, even in spite of the struggles and the barriers. And it's like, that's why it's so fun to, every time you put something on, I'm like, ah, fuck yeah. Because it just, it legitimately inspires me because
oh, good.
I always, I rarely break that. I feel like I rarely break that barrier. I'm like, I'm just going to talk myself out of it or avoid it or something.
And it is that weird thing of like tricking your brain into pretending you're safe or something. There's like a weird, you have to do all these like mind games to like force yourself. Although I have to tell you, there's one video that I made last year and I still haven't put it out. There's like, I'm like, there's something, it's just not it. And I don't know why. And it's my most personal song on the album. It's the one song that's not comedy. And so I'm just going to, I just decided that I'm going to reshoot it and we're reshooting it in 2 weeks.
But see, that's the, you know, you just, it's like the three magical words that can, I think, change a trajectory of anyone's life are, I just decided. I just decided. Mm-hmm. Because you can debate, you can go back and forth, you can stall by asking a million people for advice. When it's always good to get feedback, but sure, you can get caught in the planning stage. But until you say, I just decided, you know, mm-hmm, like even with the show, well, I just decided I'm going to do this in a year in Edinburgh. I just decided I'm going to self-release. Mm-hmm. I just decided I'm going to do this on my own. It's those words, it seemed like for you, definitely, and for most people, for everyone, I imagine, just sort of kick you into gear, because then once you make that decision, it's like, mm-hmm, well, now this is happening. So I fucking just have to figure it out. I just decided.
I decided. So this is happening. Yeah, exactly. And then it is like, I know this isn't like an advice podcast, but I think the one tricky part about that is not telling people who are going to dim your shine. Like, yes, when you decide something, a little bit, keep it to yourself in your inner circle.
Yeah, until you, and just do it. And just
until
put
it's
it out.
Already, and then once it's already going, then you can be like, you can tell anyone, be like, yeah, no, I'm 7 months into that. Yeah, I'm doing that. Like, but making sure not to, if when you're still unsure, like, cause like a look can kind of throw me off or something. So I'm like, I keep everything to myself and my closest people. And like, I told you, because you're a trustworthy source, because you are a positive light. And I, you know, I told you before I even wrote a song, I'm like, I want to do this. And like, that's, I don't do that with everybody. I only do it with people who, I feel safe with. I feel safe with telling you those things, because I know what your reaction will be, which is like, awesome. Can't wait.
Well, also,
I knew you'd say that.
And we're on these kind of similar journeys in a way, mm-hmm, you know, in terms of like our kind of solo musical journeys. But also, but yeah, I remember when you said, oh yeah, I have this idea for a song. It's called Don't Google Mommy. I was like, oh my God, it's a fucking great idea. It's a great idea. Because not only is it about your, like, just, you know, stuff that you've made for the world, but that's so universal. Of course, we're in, yes, a period now where it's like people's kids are getting, you know, it's just such a great idea. Like, fuck, that's a concept. That's a real, mm-hmm, concept. And so it's been really fun to watch from like start to finish, from those first shows you did with Natasha Leggero to like, mm-hmm, then your own shows and then your own album and then your own one person show. And so, you know, it really, I think for anyone who is listening that just feels like, I don't know what to do, like, just decide that's what you're going to do. And then something else kicks in where I think your brain just goes, well, now I got to figure it out. And, mm-hmm, you're right about
that. And the best part about not telling anyone who's unsupportive is like, say you decide and you spend 6 months on something and then you're down the wrong path. Well, you didn't even tell anyone, so it doesn't matter. Now you can pick something else. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're like, wow, yeah, I was not meant to write a horror novel or whatever it was. You're like, this is bad.
Yeah, no one's going to be like, hey, what happened to that thing? Oh, I didn't release it yet. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
you know, like, no. But I did fall into that a little bit, because I started, you know, I sent a bunch of the songs that I was making to a handful of people, just like, oh, I don't know. What do you, you know? And I don't know what I expected, but you know, the reaction was just kind of like, oh, that's cool. And it's like, oh, is that, and of course I'm reading into it and I'm going, and then I became less excited about it because I don't even know if they listened. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
But for me, what you were saying, for me, Furman's my guy for that, because, yeah, he's the loveliest, most encouraging. Oh, I really love what you did here. And I love this chord change. And it just feels so nice. So I always send, mm-hmm, him stuff. But I think that also kind of put me off too a little bit. Like, I don't know, if these were really good, someone would have been like, you gotta put these out, you know? And so, but I don't, there's gotta be a non-zero number of people that might connect with them, even if it's, you know, not that many.
Even if it's just Mike. No, I'm just kidding. No, just Mike.
Even but if like, it's just,
yeah,
German.
There's gotta be somebody, and that's fine. And like, if we wanted to be less niche, we'd be doing something else.
That's true. And, you know, again, you know, if you're just talking about the result of success or whatever, yeah, I think most people start out kind of niche and then they build their audience from there, you know? Mm-hmm. But again, if we stop thinking about this as a result, if we stop thinking about this as like, what's going to happen when I, it's like, just do it. It's a step in the process. Just decide you're going to do it. And then just remind yourself that it's a step in the process, regardless of, you can't control how it's received. You can't control, mm-hmm. once you put it out there, it's not yours anymore.
And I think, you know what I kind of loved, I found super encouraging. It's like, it's a different thing that it's like sort of what you're talking about, but did you watch the Emmys this year?
I don't know if we did actually.
There was a lot of people that won in the acting category that were, I'd never heard of before. They were older. They were like, it was like merit based. And I'm like, yeah, 2 years ago, this person was not thinking this was going to happen. And look,
probably
at
ready to give up, but just kept going somehow.
Yeah. The girl from The Pit won, and the guy from, Somebody Somewhere, like, yeah. And it's like, he like beat Harrison Ford, you know, and he like, I'm sure 2 years ago, he did not see that as a, or maybe he did, maybe he was a believer manifester, but it is like, you never know.
No, you don't. And that's why if you talk yourself out of stuff, you could be talking yourself out of like the last inch before you were about to reach whatever thing. But I think it's also important, even in success, it's important to think about it all as part of the process, because the success thing doesn't, I don't think that lasts as long as people might think, like, well, that's the goalpost. So once I get that, then everything's going to feel fixed. And I think a lot of people find themselves very confused and disappointed when that doesn't just fix every problem in their life.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, now what? And then they have a real existential crisis. And it's like, but if you can just appreciate those moments when they happen, but then just keep going, you know, like the way you were going to go anyway, then it's probably a little bit healthier rather than pinning all of your identity mm-hmm. and value on this success metric that is, it's a phantom.
Yeah. Like, how do you like stay sparkly and inspired?
I think it's just pursuing things that are interesting to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes those things are personal and sometimes those things are just silly, but it doesn't really matter. It's just like whatever, wherever you're drawn, I think is where you're supposed to go. But I really hope that, I hope we get to hang out in person. And
me too. And I hope you put out your Haunted Mansion thing. I really want to see that.
I might do that. I mean, I literally have like 20 songs that I'm just sitting on. But talking to you, I feel very comfortable talking about how insecure I am about it because I want other people to know how normal that is, but I also want them to fall on your side of the fence where it's like, yeah, feel that, but do it anyway. Make the decision. Yeah. If it's important, you decide that that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And you're very inspiring to me for that. And I just adore you and appreciate you. And
likewise,
you are
so
accomplished
you
and you're likable and wonderful. And
thank you.
Just,
so are you.
I fucking hope you get nominated for a Grammy.
Thank you. I'm trying. I always try. I'll try everything, you know.
Are you already writing the next stable of stuff?
You know, I have some ideas, but they're not quite there yet.
Okay.
I'm still, because I'm filming 2 music videos in a week. I'm still in like,
gotcha.
You know, mining this album, but I have some ideas. I'm still trying to figure it out. I want to do something a little different, but I don't know what exactly. Like,
well, I hope we can get Dimity and Keaton hanging out.
Yes, I would love
that. I think
it'd
be fun. She's at an age now where she just loves to play with other kids and she's super social and fun. And, you know, I'd love for them to meet and, you know, and please give Fred a hug for me. And,
I will. It was so nice to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you too. And
thank you for
hopefully
having
I'll see you soon. And also everyone, no worries if not, they can get on Spotify, Apple Music, you know, self-distributed, self-produced, self-generated.
Yep.
Just decide. You just decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. It was so nice to see you.
Good to see you too, Ricky.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.